Good morning. It's Tuesday, the 11th of August, and you're listening to the Wall Street Journal here on Sun Sounds of Arizona. This is your volunteer reader and Flagstaff, Chuck Kaufman, bringing you news from the Wall Street Journal. And today we have on the front page these headlines: how a Tesla-SpaceX merger would get Musk to his $1 trillion payday, inflation reports post-test for new Fed chair, and the American tourist has become unstoppable. That first headline by Theo Francis and Andrew Molica: how a Tesla-SpaceX merger would get Musk to his $1 trillion payday. Deep in a $1 trillion payday package approved by Tesla shareholders is an escape clause that could pay off for Elon Musk in several ways if he folds the automaker into his SpaceX empire. That kind of cars and rockets tie-up, the subject of widespread speculation among investors and hinted at by Musk himself, would likely give him the tighter control he's long sought at Tesla. A hefty enough price would also, in an instant, wipe away key performance targets standing between Musk and billions of dollars in shares. This $1 trillion that was supposed to be a stretch, said Mary Ellen Carter, a Boston College accounting professor who studies executive pay. Turns out it isn't really that hard. All you have to do is be bought. Musk has considerable say over any offer SpaceX makes for Tesla because of his sweeping control over the rocket company. The upshot? Even a stratospheric bid could keep Musk in firm control of the combined company. Tesla shareholders voted to adopt the pay package last fall. Under ordinary circumstances, it would deliver to Musk as much as 423.7 million shares if Tesla hits a series of 12 market value targets and the company also meets just as many cash flow and operating goals. Among them, delivering Tesla's 20 millionth vehicle, selling 1 million robots, and putting 1 million robo-taxis on the street. First, a technical note. Musk's much-ballyhooed potential payout of $1 trillion in stock would now top out around $824 billion. That's because the number of Tesla shares outstanding has risen since shareholders approved the deal. In other words, the same $8.5 trillion market value would be spread across more shares, reducing the value of Musk's new slug of shares. The record-setting equity award was designed to align extraordinary long-term shareholder value with incentives that will drive peak performance from our visionary leader, Tesla Chair Robin Denholms told shareholders at the time. Yet tucked into the bottom of the fifth page of the 16-page 2025 CEO Performance Award Agreement, a single sentence declares half the targets are as good as accomplished if Tesla is acquired or otherwise taken over. That would leave only market value targets to determine how many shares Musk gets. The same clause says those targets would be met or missed based on the final deal price or on Tesla's market capitalization immediately before any acquisition closed if that is higher. Musk, SpaceX, and Tesla didn't respond to requests for comment. Tesla shareholders could think it's terrible and the Tesla price drops ahead of any deal, Carter said, but it's whatever SpaceX is willing to offer. Every $500 billion added to the deal price would deliver as many shares again, up to $7.5 trillion. An $8.5 trillion dollar acquisition, more than six times Tesla's recent market value, would deliver the pay package's full 424 million shares. That's the number of shares that would have clinched the maximum $1 trillion stock award for Musk. There are a few clear constraints on what SpaceX would offer to acquire Tesla: Musk's holding of SpaceX Class A shares with one vote apiece and Class B with 10 give him about 86% of any SpaceX vote needed to approve a deal. By controlling most B shares, he can also appoint a majority of the company's board, which oversees deals. The company's legal home of Texas largely protects SpaceX from shareholder lawsuits over any Tesla acquisition unless plaintiffs own at least 3% of the company. That's a tall order, said Ann Lipton, a University of Colorado law professor specializing in corporate law. Legally, he has the power to do whatever. Shareholders would have to bless any deal at Tesla, where Musk now holds just under 20% of the vote. Although Tesla is also in Texas, disgruntled shareholders there would have a clearer path to suing, raising the importance of getting investors on board, she said. He needs to persuade the Tesla shareholders. There are other possible scenarios. SpaceX has a third non-voting class of shares, but hasn't issued any yet. Using those to acquire Tesla could avoid or reduce diluting the votes of existing SpaceX shareholders, albeit at the risk of resistance from Tesla investors. Potential complications lurk, too. Musk might want to keep acquisition costs down to avoid cutting too deeply into the ownership and voting power, however limited, of existing SpaceX shareholders. Many are longtime supporters who signed on with the company's initial public offering just weeks ago. And that's how a Tesla-SpaceX merger would get Musk to his $1 trillion payday. Our next item, inflation reports pose test for new Fed chair. Monthly readings take on outsized import after Walsh's tough talk on prices. This is by Nick Timoreos. Federal Reserve Chairman Kevin Warsh envisions a central bank whose interest rate decisions don't hinge on the latest monthly data. That vision might have to wait. Two inflation reports over the next month are set to shape whether his colleagues push to raise rates in September or extend their pause. A cool number in Wednesday's release of the July Consumer Price Index would relieve pressure on both Warsh personally and a policy committee weighing whether it has misread the U.S. economy. A firm one could force him to demonstrate with actions what he struggled last month to convey in words. The Consumer Price Index feeds into the Fed's preferred inflation gauge to be published later this month. Economists expect core consumer prices, which exclude food and energy, to have risen 0.2% in July. Monthly readings at or below that level would be consistent with inflation returning to the Fed's 2% goal. Anything higher would not. Core inflation in the preferred gauge was 3.5% in June, up from 2.8% a year earlier. The monthly readings have taken on outsized importance for two reasons. First, several officials in forecasts released in June and speeches since have said they expect inflation will return to their 2% goal without tighter policy. They thought tariffs would raise prices once and fade, and energy would follow crude oil lower as Middle East hostilities quieted. Instead, the shocks have persisted and overlapped with a newer one, surge in prices for technology equipment and software tied to the artificial intelligence build-out. The coming reports will show whether these officials can still defend their forecasts. Second, Warsh has made getting inflation down his signature theme. That's left him with expectations to meet. The Fed held rates steady last month, as broadly expected, but investors reacted with doubts when Warsh didn't explain the decision. Asked whether higher rates were the remedy if inflation didn't come down, Warsh said they could be part of, but maybe not primarily, the solution. He suggested rising bond yields had done some of the Fed's work and hinted at redefining the Fed's inflation objective. That left investors unsure whether Warsh was willing to fight inflation with more than talk. Analysts said the Fed had good reasons to hold steady even if Warsh didn't state them. Labor costs have been growing slowly relative to productivity, making a broad price breakout less likely. Tariff-related contributions appear to be fading, and methodological changes should revise down core inflation in the Fed's preferred gauge in September. The 30-year Treasury yield rose while Warsh spoke and hasn't come back down, which can reflect doubts about whether the central bank will act to bring inflation down if necessary. That kind of move is unusual around a policy meeting, said James Egelhoff, chief U.S. economist at BNP Paribas. and suggested something more fundamental is afoot related to the market's perception of the Warsh Fed. Speaking in gauzy principles rather than specifics could leave Warsh facing more pressure to prove he will act, said Paul McCulley, former chief economist at PIMCO. He's done it with such bombast that actually, practically speaking, he's limited his options, he said. 10 of 19 officials who participated in July's policy meeting, including half of all 12 voters, spoke publicly in the days after the meeting, supplying reasoning that Warsh hadn't. At least 6 of the voters have signaled in recent weeks they could eventually support raising rates if inflation doesn't improve. 3 of them dissented last month in favor of raising rates. Warsh's comments raised doubts among some observers over his motives, whether he's playing down the need for rate increases because he believes tough talk can delay action, or because he wants to avoid a confrontation with President Trump, who appointed him and has demanded the Fed keep rates low. Those who know him have said he would reject both explanations. People sympathetic to Warsh acknowledge the confusion created by the news conference might need to be addressed, perhaps when he speaks later this month at the Kansas City Fed's annual conference in Jackson Hole, Wyoming. Some said the reaction has been overblown, noting that market-based measures of expected inflation are little changed. The market reaction isn't telling as dire a story as the market commentators are, said Donald Cohen, a former Fed vice chairman. But you don't want to go into that press conference and get the results you got. Long-term rates up, short-term rates down. The calm might also be misleading. July's setback is surmountable because it was the first. If investors expect a move in September and don't get one, there's nothing to stop the Treasury market from repeating what it did last month. Warsh came to the Fed intending to change how it communicates. He believes telling markets what factors and conditions would prompt action can tie the central bank's hands and cloud a useful signal. What investors think the economy requires. Less guidance, in his view, delivers a cleaner read. That approach has a cost, Cohn said. If you don't articulate what you're thinking about and how you're thinking about it, then how will you know when your thoughts are not being validated? If the July and August inflation reports are firm, Warsh could face a choice between raising rates or staying on hold while absorbing a fourth or fifth dissent. If the Fed holds, the doubts that surfaced in July would be harder to dispel. Mild readings would spare him all of that. The hawks would have less of a case to press, and Warsh could use Jackson Hole to lay out his thinking on his own terms rather than under pressure from recent data. The importance placed on 2 monthly reports is an uncomfortable spot for a chairman who has argued against letting individual releases drive policy. The historic problem with data dependence is the data and the dependence, he said last month. Reports draw this much attention precisely when they could confirm the existing trend or signal a new one. The Fed has often put off a move without much consequence because timing matters less when investors understand what it is doing and why. But that protection might not be there when investors can't get a read on the new chair. The Fed's next meeting after September falls days before the midterm elections, a moment when officials might be reluctant to make a first rate increase. That effectively pushes a deferred decision to December, meaning 4 more months resting on an inflation forecast Warsh's colleagues are already struggling to defend. And that's Inflation Reports Pose Test for New Fed Chair. Now we have the American tourist has become unstoppable. A supercharged U.S. economy has helped transform a nation. This is by Rachel Louise Ensign and Chelsea Delaney. Al Lenz's parents traveled overseas 3 times after emigrating to the U.S. in 1961. Lenza estimates he's taken 500 trips in 50 years. His home office is filled with self-printed books with recollections from each one. He's working on more. The semi-retired 70-year-old has already been to Barcelona 3 times in the past year. You have more time and more money, he said of his current phase of life. the clock is running out. American travel has transformed in recent decades. A nation of former homebodies has become one of zealous and moneyed international travelers, infiltrating every cobblestone corner of Europe and rapidly filling lesser-known destinations. Americans took a record 24 million trips to Europe in 2025. Portugal received nearly five times the number of U.S. visitors last year as it did a decade earlier. Greece took in four times as many. Consulting firm Tourism Economics expects American visits to Europe will have increased another 5% by the end of the year. The travel is helping boost economies, even as it has angered many locals who say their cities, now reliant on foreign visitors, are no longer serving them. Behind the shift is a supercharged U.S. economy that, in the course of a generation, has created a larger and wealthier class of Americans that views travel as an essential rather than a luxury. Older Americans who are driving this new era of travel hold about $110 trillion in wealth. They're also living longer and looking to make the most of those years. That rising wealth has coincided with dramatic changes in the travel industry itself. Foreign travel has become more accessible, and social media has made it easy to envy, emulate, and one-up friends' vacations. New Grand Tour. A trip to the continent is a well-worn path for U.S. elites. In the 1800s, wealthy Americans embarked on the type of grand tours that were popular among British aristocrats, spending months traveling across Europe to see historic sites, learn languages, and collect paintings, said Eric Zulow, a history professor at the University of New England. By the 1950s and 60s, when boomers were growing up, Americans traveling abroad were in rare air. A glamorous jet set who wore their best for flights on Pan Am and TWA. They were soon joined by young, adventurous backpackers who filled hostels and traveled on the cheap. As the Cold War waned and airlines expanded, travel opened up further to the masses. And the European Union's free travel area made it easy to fly to the continent and hop between countries. In 1990, fewer than 5% of Americans had a passport. Now, more than 50% do, aided in part by a mandate requiring passports for travel to Canada, Mexico, and the Caribbean that took effect in 2007 and a post-pandemic travel rush. The U.S. issued a record 27 million passports in fiscal 2025. Amy Birch Buchanan, 55, took her first flight in 1988 to visit her then boyfriend in England. She had a cassette tape full of journey songs to listen to on the plane, and her parents walked her directly to the gate. On board, passengers were dressed to the nines, sipping cocktails and smoking cigarettes. Nobody was wearing yoga pants. It was very elegant, said Buchanan, who lives in Fort Worth, Texas. She returned home a changed woman, with British bands like Depeche Mode on her Walkman, new clothes, and a wanderlust that she eventually passed down to her three kids. Her eldest daughter, Avery, moved to the UK around 2 years ago and now travels across Europe. Her middle daughter went to Kenya this year. They've really reached out much further as they've gone on their own, she said. Europe is often the gateway drug. Portugal and Greece have seen the biggest percentage increases in U.S. visitors of any country over the past decade, according to the U.S. government data. The U.K. and Italy have seen the largest increases in the total number of tourists, getting millions of additional Americans a year arriving by air. Only about 6% of U.S. travelers to Europe in 2025 said it was their first time flying abroad. Many of these tourists are visiting multiple times a year, stopping at the Eiffel Tower and the Colosseum, but also taking country walks in the Cotswolds and Viking cruises on the Danube. A growing share of consumer spending is going toward foreign travel as habits change and prices rise. Open skies agreements deregulated airline competition on international routes starting in the 1990s, leading to much cheaper airfares and more international flights from the U.S., said Clifford Winston, a Brookings Institution economist who studied the pacts. In 1984, a round-trip weekend fare between New York and London on Pan Am cost $669, today's equivalent of $2,150, according to a Wall Street Journal from the time. Over the past decade, economy airfare to the region rose 56%, more than inflation. The average one-way economy plane ticket from the U.S. to Europe, not including taxes and fees, cost $588 this year, up from $535 in 2025, according to aviation analytics company Cirium. Lenza, who does tech work for the travel industry, estimates that he and his wife spend between $100,000 and $200,000 on travel each year, even as they try to be cautious with other kinds of spending. One of their recent visits to Barcelona was for a cruise from the city with two of their grandchildren, who are 19 and 22. The trip, like others they've treated their grandkids to, was nicer than the ones the Lenzes could take their three daughters on when they were growing up. "Our daughters remind us every once in a while that it's not fair," he said. "Travel isn't optional, it's essential, especially for younger people," said Audrey Hendley, president of American Express Travel. The credit card company, which has a high-end clientele, said travel bookings through its platform increased 22% in the past year. U.S. travelers to the region skew female, with women 55 and over making up 24%. More than 15% of Americans living, or rather visiting, Europe reported a household income of $300,000 or more. They are increasingly rich, sophisticated, and willing to travel to see not just the highlights, but to go beyond the highlights, said Seth Borko, head of research at Skift, an American travel trade publication. Radiologist Andy Robbins ramped up international travel a few years before retiring from his full-time medical practice in 2019. Last year, the 68-year-old and his wife, Char Robbins, went to Oktoberfest in Germany, took a Rhone River cruise, and visited Liechtenstein for a day, just to say we've been there, he said. This year, the couple visited Denmark, the Czech Republic, and Germany again. They've already booked a 2-week guided tour of Scandinavia and a cruise from Venice to Istanbul for next year. He still takes on part-time work when he's not traveling. "One of the reasons I joke that I'm still working is that I like my business class sleeper seats," said Robbins, who estimates they spend about $60,000 to $70,000 a year on travel abroad. The first time Robbins vacationed in Europe was in 2007, when he was 49. The couple traveled with their daughter, who was 10 at the time, to Scotland, London, and Paris. His daughter loved the Harry Potter-themed room in their Edinburgh hotel. "It was magical," he said. "The magic is often lost on locals. The influx of tourists has brought in new wealth in many places, but it's also straining infrastructure, raising the cost of living, and disrupting local life. Housing has become scarce and unaffordable in some cities, with more apartments being used as pricey short-term vacation rentals." Tens of thousands protested against over-tourism on the Spanish island of Mallorca last month, demanding fewer visitors and more affordable housing. The march turned violent as protesters clashed with police, who fired rubber bullets after being pelted with plastic bottles. Protests have broken out in other European hotspots in recent years, including in Italy and Portugal. In Barcelona, which last year received 9 times as many tourists as it has residents, protesters took to spraying water on tourists. Europe's Catch-22. Governments across the continent are starting to impose limits on tourism, cracking down on Airbnbs, slapping taxes on tourists, and limiting cruise ship numbers and new hotel construction. But it's a catch-22, as attracting Americans remains a priority for many businesses because they tend to spend more and stay longer than other tourists. Plus, Americans tip. Americans visiting Spain last year spent nearly $350 a day, well above the roughly $200 a day spent by Germans and about $150 by French travelers. In Greece, Americans spent 9 nights on average in 2025, compared with 7 nights for tourists from the UK. "They just come on vacation to spend," said Panos Panis, manager at a company that does boat trips on the Greek island of Crete. They don't come to buy an ice cream and sit on the beach for 7 hours, for example, like most Europeans do. They're very busy. They want to do things. Many Americans are going beyond the usual mass tours, adding bespoke experiences that connect them with locals. They're paying more than $200 a person for semi-private tours of the Colosseum, visiting Scottish farms where they can brush Highland cows, and taking perfume-making classes in Paris. Nate Oester and Anna Lee from Port Townsend, Washington, were browsing a stand selling dish towels and tableware in London's Borough Market at lunchtime on a recent afternoon. The couple, who are both engineers, had just finished a month-long 538-mile cycling trip through the UK, starting in Inverness, Scotland, and ending in Penzance, England, near the western tip of Cornwall. Oester, 44, and Lee, 41, mostly took domestic vacations growing up in their 20s. They both went on some overseas trips, but they started regularly traveling abroad for cycling trips once they got together and started earning more. That's when I was really like, oh, I'm making up for lost time. I'm getting out there. I love this, said Oester. It was so hot at points during their UK trip that they covered themselves with wet towels to cool down at night since their hotels didn't have air conditioning. Still, they're already dreaming of coming back to cycle down the Rhone from Switzerland to the Mediterranean. We both have good jobs and no kids, so we're able to travel, said Oester with an interjection from Lee. For many in Gen Z, the wanderlust seems to only be stronger. Tesla Coyle, 24, doesn't have any friends who haven't gone abroad. Coyle lived in Australia for part of her childhood and traveled extensively growing up. Earlier this year, Coyle left her investment banking job in New York for one in tech, in part so she could have more time for travel. In June, she took a 10-day trip to Greece with a friend that cost her about $3,000. She used Anthropic's Claude to help plan the trip, using its suggestions to pick destinations. Leery of the crowds, Coyle was content to see the Acropolis from a distance. Her favorite part of the trip was visiting the quieter island of Sifnos, where they enjoyed drinks at a cliffside wine bar. She's not intimidated even by the most far-flung destinations. She hopes to travel to Kyrgyzstan and stay in a yurt after seeing Instagram posts about the destination. I'm dying to go, she said. You're having a unique experience. And that's The American Tourist Has Become Unstoppable. You're listening to the Wall Street Journal here on Sun Sounds of Arizona. This is your volunteer reader reminding you you can listen to the Wall Street Journal and other Sun Sounds of Arizona programming by going to the Sun Sounds of Arizona website, and that's available at sunsounds.org. Or you can download the Sun Sounds of Arizona app, available from the Apple App Store for your iPhone or iPad, or the Google Play Store for your Android phone or tablet. And you can always listen to Sun Sounds of Arizona streaming on your Amazon Dot, Echo, or Show. Turning now to the business and finance section of the Wall Street Journal, we have these headlines. Zuckerberg sets AI vision. A chicken glut, both fair and foul. And traders rush into AI, dump crypto holdings. That first headline, Zuckerberg sets AI vision. Plans aim to boost public acceptance, define oversight, drive open models. This is by Megan Bobrowski. Mark Zuckerberg has a new game plan for winning over hearts and minds to his company's artificial intelligence efforts, open models, and an open hand. In a wide-ranging essay, the Meta Platform's chief executive outlined a new course of action he presented as a way to spread the wealth and opportunity from AI to users around the world and to residents of the communities that host the data centers powering it. Zuckerberg's plans include releasing more open-weight models and establishing a fund to invest in the communities where Meta hosts data centers. The fund size will be $1 billion, a Meta spokeswoman said. In his essay, Zuckerberg advanced a number of policy recommendations, including a proposal for how the federal government should work with companies to safety test new models and call for allowing AI developers to distill one another's models. He also said Meta's own board of directors would have more of a say over the safety criteria its models adhere to in the future. He made the case that his company's approach to developing powerful AI, one that focuses on distributing it as widely as possible and pushing many decisions about values to the end user, is the one that's least likely to lead to disastrous outcomes such as totalitarianism, mass unemployment, or the rise of an unstoppable computer mind that threatens humanity. Most other labs are focused on building AI for companies, governments, or other institutions, so if those labs lead, then the balance of power will favor larger institutions over individuals, he wrote. Meta's mission, since our founding, has been focused on putting power in people's hands. If our beliefs and principles lead, then the balance of power will favor individuals and a better future for everyone. Meta's lagging behind in the AI race and trying to catch up to Anthropic and OpenAI, which have the most advanced AI models. Zuckerberg earlier published a shorter version of the essay as an opinion column in the Wall Street Journal and previewed some of his arguments in several media interviews, including one in the Journal. As part of his plan, Meta is launching a new model with open weights, meaning users will be able to download the numerical values that determine its behavior, called Muse Glimmer, and in the coming weeks will also release an open weight version of its most advanced model, Muse Spark 1.2, the Meta spokeswoman said. The commitment marks a significant development in the debate around whether advanced AI is too dangerous to create on an open source basis and should be developed only within labs that keep its code tightly held. Zuckerberg also wrote that one of the U.S.'s current disadvantages in its race against China to develop superintelligent computer systems is the difficulty of building infrastructure stateside. Meta is planning up to $145 billion on capital spending this year, largely to build data centers, and $600 billion by 2028. We would all benefit together by figuring out the community compacts required to enable sustainable development across the country, he said. To that end, Meta is doling out more money to local communities near its data centers, though Zuckerberg's essay didn't specify what that would entail. In his essay, he referenced a local sales tax earmark that led to teachers in Richland Parish, Louisiana, receiving $50,000 bonus checks funded by increased economic activity near the company's Hyperion data center campus. His comments come amid increasing public opposition to data center development in the U.S. over the past few months. A few weeks ago, New York banned the construction of the facilities in the state for up to a year. Investors are also getting impatient with Meta's AI ambitions and want the company to rake in bigger returns sooner. Zuckerberg recently teased the idea of launching a cloud computing business to directly monetize its investments in data center infrastructure. But a lack of detail about the potential venture in the company's July earnings call led to a sell-off in Meta shares. And that's Zuckerberg Sets AI Vision. Patrick Thomas writes our next article, A Chicken Glut, Both Fair and Foul. Poultry companies are producing more chicken than consumers can buy, depressing wholesale prices and squeezing their profits. The dynamic sets up potential inflation relief for shoppers and restaurants looking to pare down their costs for protein. Suppliers such as Tyson Foods, Pilgrim's Pride, and Wayne Sanderson Farms have been ramping up offerings of boneless chicken breasts, wings, and thighs over the past year to meet what was expected to be an onslaught of consumer demand. More Americans were expected to spurn pricier steaks and burgers in favor of cheaper chicken sandwiches and tenders. Beef demand hasn't cooled. Bigger chicken breeds and flocks not being decimated by disease over the summer have led to a glut in an industry that slaughters more than 9 billion birds a year. Chicken suppliers were up about 4.5% in the quarter ended June 28th from the prior year, according to Pilgrim's Pride, the second largest U.S. poultry processor. The headcount was a little higher than everybody anticipated, Pilgrim's Pride chief executive Fabio Sandri said on a July investor call. Demand was more than offset by the increase in supply. Wholesale prices for boneless, skinless chicken breasts are down about 37% from 12 months ago, according to FactSet. Weaker prices have weighed on profit margins. Second quarter profit for Pilgrim's Pride fell 96% from a year earlier to $13.4 million. Large volume buyers and ultimately consumers are likely beneficiaries from falling prices. Retail prices for boneless chicken breasts were down about 1.4% in June from a year prior, according to the Labor Department. The cheaper prices have allowed Midwest grocery chain Fairway Stores to run a number of poultry promotions aimed at getting more shoppers in its stores. Jeff Cook, Vice President of Market Operations, said the grocer ran a month-long sale of $1.99 per pound of chicken breasts earlier this year and several $2.99 per pound promotions. The grocer had been pricing its breasts at about $4.99 per pound. Poultry hasn't seen the seasonal increases like it usually has, he said. Good Food Holdings, which owns supermarkets like Bristol Farms in California, is earning higher profit margins on chicken and then using some of the savings to reduce prices for consumers on more expensive beef products like 80/20 ground beef and New York strip steak, CEO Neil Stern said. Restaurants are also adding more chicken items to their menus to have cheaper protein options for their patrons, according to industry officials. The best way you could be lowering your food costs right now is by having a more poultry-forward menu, said Kevin Hurricane, the CEO of food distributor Sysco. Poultry prices are historically volatile. Processors are constantly trying to match the number of chicks they need to hatch to the amount of meat their customers are willing to buy. Periods of low wholesale prices or high grain prices can put some chicken companies in dire financial conditions. Over the past few years, chicken has been immensely profitable for meat packers. Massive corn and soybean crops have made livestock feed, the top expenses when raising a chicken, cheap. Meanwhile, demand for chicken cuts has been steadily climbing, driven by Americans' appetite for protein. But poultry companies ended up hatching too many chicks and overestimating demand. Through the first 6 months of this year, companies slaughtered more than 4.9 billion chickens, up 3% from the same period last year, and up 6% from 5 years ago. One thing hurting the chicken business, consumers love beef. Even though beef prices are at record levels due to a nationwide cattle shortage, that hasn't dented demand. Retail sales volumes were up 2% for 52 weeks that ended July the 12th, according to market research firm Circana. Favorable weather conditions helped more birds reach maturity than expected, poultry executives said. Diseases such as bird flu, which have previously decimated flocks, haven't been as much of a factor in key chicken-raising regions. Roughly 90 to 95% of birds in a commercial chicken barn survive the 6 to 8 weeks it takes until they're ready for slaughter. Even a small uptick could result in millions of extra chickens moving through processors' plants. The industry shot themselves in the foot this year, said Puran Sharma, an agricultural analyst for financial services firm Stephens. All you had to do was just be disciplined around production. A new genetic line of chickens is also fueling the glut. The poultry industry has for years prioritized breeding bigger chickens, aiming to increase the amount of products harvested from each bird. Cobb Vantress, owned by Tyson Foods, rolled out a new chicken breed this year that grows faster on less feed, producing more meat at a lower cost. Tyson, the biggest U.S. chicken processor, has struggled in the past with breeds that produced unexpectedly high numbers of unhatched eggs. Tyson executives recently said the company is more insulated than its competitors from depressed prices after years spent improving its chicken operations. Now, most of the chicken processed at its plants goes into the company's Tyson-branded frozen pre-cooked products sold in grocery stores where demand is growing. In the past, the company sold more of its chicken to other processors, distributors, or restaurant customers at lower wholesale prices. Pilgrim's has been trying to grow its branded products business. The company has rolled out new chicken nugget lines in recent years and said it's grown its Just Bear brand to 13% of chicken market share from 1% in 3 years. That's a chicken glut, both fair and foul. Our next article, Traders Rush into AI Dump Crypto Holdings. This is by Vicky Gihang. Daniel Koss piled into Bitcoin thinking crypto would revolutionize finance. Then AI came along. The 30-year-old investor thought the rapidly developing technology had the potential to upend entire industries, and he rushed to get in on the action. He dumped his six-figure position in Bitcoin in August last year and is now entirely invested in artificial intelligence. Felt a bit like a caveman who found fire, said Koss, who's based in Zug, Switzerland. Koss's pivot reflects a broader migration across markets over the past year. Individual traders and hedge funds alike dumping Bitcoin and other tokens to chase AI stocks. The rotation helps explain why Bitcoin has remained stuck at around $60,000 after crashing from its record of more than $126,000 in October, when President Trump's threat of new tariffs on China sent investors fleeing riskier assets. Chip makers and other AI stocks, meanwhile, have posted the kind of surges once associated with crypto. What's happening in crypto is the purge just getting started, said Mike McClone, senior commodity strategist at Bloomberg Intelligence. Bitcoin's decline comes as stocks have hit repeated new highs this year. But on Monday, major indexes edged lower. The S&P 500 slipped less than a tenth of a percent. The Dow Jones Industrial Average edged lower, dropping a tenth of a percent or 61 points. The tech-focused NASDAQ was down three-tenths of a percent. Oil prices rose, with Brent crude futures gaining nearly 5% to $87.72 a barrel. Koss has no plans to trade Bitcoin again soon, saying he believes the asset has matured to a point where explosive parabolic gains are a thing of the past. He said he doesn't think there'll ever again be a year where Bitcoin's value increases tenfold, I think even doubling as high, because it's so big, he said. Even some diehard crypto believers have trimmed their positions in favor of fast-moving AI shares. Ryan Ho, founder of social trading app Legend, said he held a seven-figure Bitcoin position when the digital currency traded near $120,000. At the time, he believed it would never go below $100,000 again, he said. Then it did just that. By this past December, he'd rotated out of many of his positions in Bitcoin and altcoins into chipmakers and other AI stocks, including Intel. He still has a few $100,000 invested in Bitcoin. The 25-year-old said a key driver behind his exit was the structural weakness in the crypto market. In Ho's view, the crypto market stopped behaving like a healthy risk asset after the October crash. Buyer demand dried up and institutional capital rotated to AI. The market subsequently decoupled from stocks, which continued to climb. Ho said the potential for AI's growth was more compelling to everyday investors because it was grounded in real-world uses, such as from ChatGPT to AI-assisted coding. Another factor fueling the switch from crypto to AI. Popular trading platforms for crypto traders, such as Hyperliquid, embraced AI derivatives. That's why most crypto traders started trading AI equities over the past few months. It's just because it's become available to do, Ho said. Other crypto traders simply wanted to cash out after a blistering run for Bitcoin and major tokens. Min Lee, a trader and digital artist, said he recently sold some to buy a Ferrari. He also rotated a meaningful portion of his gains into Japanese anime-based collectibles, including One Piece and Pokemon trading cards. Lee said he built digital wealth through non-fungible tokens and meme coins. The Los Angeles-based trader got his start in 2017 purchasing Litecoin, a once popular cryptocurrency, on a credit card before scaling up his bets using stimulus checks during the pandemic. Lee cashed out aggressively soon after buying up Trump's meme coin, which the president launched right before his inauguration. "That was some of the fastest money I've ever made in my life," he said. "I knew that it was time to step away from the table." And that's Traders Rush Into AI Dump Crypto Holdings. Our next article, End of Good Lease Deals Tests Electric Vehicle Owners Resolve. This is by Ellie Davis. Mark Block's friend wouldn't stop bragging about the great lease deal he got for his 2024 Hyundai Ioniq 6. When Mark and his wife Ida saw that they too could get a sleek, electric $50,000 car for $340 a month after a $4,000 down payment, they couldn't resist. They liked their new battery-powered sedan, but when their lease was due back and they went looking for a similar deal, they faced higher prices and fewer options. "Never in my life have I looked at the car market and gone, 'God, there's just nothing I want,'" Mark Block said. In the end, they took home a hybrid, a Honda Civic. The home charger that they got for the Hyundai is still in their garage with no car to plug into. The Blocks are among a crowd of consumers who dipped their toes into electric cars in an era when the deals were too good to pass up. The Biden-era $7,500 EV tax credit helped entice buyers to go electric, and many automakers offered heavily subsidized lease deals and discounts as regulations pushed them toward battery power. Today, that's no longer the case. The tax credit is gone. Automakers are less motivated to push for an electric future. Several EV models have bowed out of the market, and prices are up, leaving one-time EV leasers who like their cars with few affordable options. The situation is testing long-standing data that shows when people go electric, most stay electric. A February study from J.D. Power showed that 96% of polled EV owners say they would consider purchasing or leasing another, but that outcome is contingent on having options in the EV market. Nationally, second quarter new EV sales and leases were down 20.5% a year over year, according to Kelley Blue Book. "There is defection from that EV market," said Ivan Drury, an Edmunds automotive analyst. "I think the one biggest problem, it's a mental hurdle to say, 'Man, I used to be paying $200 a month. Now you guys want $500? Ahead of the $7,500 tax credit's expiration in September 2025, dealers were eager to get the cars off their lots as fast as possible. Average monthly lease payments for EVs hit a low of $538 in July 2025, according to data from Edmunds. Some dealerships offered lease deals for EVs with monthly payments of less than $100. As of June, average monthly lease payments for EVs have risen to $707 compared with average monthly payment of $607 for a non-EV, according to Edmunds data. Carl Schmidt said that at his Mazda, Subaru, and Kia dealerships in Los Angeles, the enticing deals got buyers to opt for EVs. Now, when people who leased an EV come into their dealership hoping for another, they've been in for a rude awakening, he said. It's always a difficult conversation when somebody comes in and you have to show them a $250 to $300 higher payment, Schmidt said. Some buyers set on keeping an EV have decided to bite the bullet. Srivatsa Srinivasan saw his monthly payment for an EV more than double. The now-retired Virginia resident used the EV tax credit to get an $819 monthly payment after a roughly $11,000 deposit on a 2024 Rivian RIS quad motor. The car would cost $121,990 to purchase. Leasing another example of the same model in May when his term was up would have cost him $1,900 a month. Ahead of the lease's expiration, Sirinis Vasan instead opted to buy a similar R1S with a zero-interest financing plan. He now pays $2,100 a month. Since he'd grown accustomed to the car and wanted to keep putting his home EV charger to use, he decided the price tag was worth it. I said, "You know what? I'm going to take the plunge. Take a hit on this," he said. In California, the largest EV market in America and a state whose regulations have heavily driven the zero-emission car market, lawmakers are trying to replace the lost EV incentives. A new program signed into law by Governor Gavin Newsom in July offers first-time EV buyers $3,500 off new electric vehicles with a price tag of less than $50,000 and $1,750 off used electric vehicles selling for less than $25,000. Buyers who have previously leased an EV aren't eligible. For the past 4 years in California, buyers took home more new EVs than hybrids. But in the first half of 2026, 22.1% of new cars sold were hybrids compared with 15.9% EVs, according to data from the California New Dealers Association. And that's End of Good Lease Deals Tests Electric Vehicle Owners Resolve. Let's turn now to the Heard on the Street section of the Wall Street Journal. And we have this headline, War Helps Chinese EVs Make Inroads. High gasoline prices are giving a boost to the nation's electric vehicle exports. One group that doesn't want the Iran war to end soon is China's electric vehicle makers. They began the year with a glut of EVs on their hands and weak demand at home. The crisis in the Middle East is helping them export their way out of trouble. Chinese carmakers are sending excess supply to overseas markets where high gasoline prices are prompting more drivers to buy EVs. The market share of traditional carmakers is the big casualty. China's EV exports rose 120% in the first half of 2026 from the same period of last year, data from the International Energy Agency shows. EV sales have roughly doubled in Brazil, Australia, Korea, and Vietnam since the war began. EV sales in Colombia have quadrupled based on IEA data. The Energy Agency now expects EVs to make up 29% of new car sales globally in 2026, an increase from 25% last year. The shift away from gasoline cars is further along in China, where more than half of all new cars sold are now electric. China's car manufacturers would love to see rapid Chinese-style electrification happen elsewhere. They control 60% of EV sales across emerging markets compared with just 10% for traditional combustion engine cars, so they have the most to gain from widespread EV adoption. High tariffs are keeping them out of the U.S. and protecting American carmakers such as Ford from an onslaught of competition in their home market. EV sales have also been falling in the U.S. since a Biden-era tax subsidy expired in the third quarter of last year. Buying an EV still doesn't pencil out for a typical American driver, even with higher prices at the pump. Based on current car prices and auto loan rates, EVs won't be competitive with internal combustion cars unless gasoline hits roughly $4.80 a gallon, according to Clearview Energy Partners analysis. But in Europe and the UK, where tariffs are less punitive, Chinese car brands, including Geely and BYD, are appearing more frequently on the roads. In June, five Chinese brands, Geely, SAIC, Motor, BYD, Chery, and Leap Motor, accounted for 12.1% of new car registrations in the EU and UK, up from 7.7% in the same month of last year, based on numbers from the European Automobile Manufacturers Association. New registrations also rose for Tesla. The share of new car registrations for European brands Volkswagen and Renault, as well as Ford, slipped over the period. Volkswagen Group increasingly has to defend its home turf at the same time in its business in China sinks. Volkswagen's vehicle deliveries to China fell 37% from a year earlier in the second quarter because of intense competition from local brands and weak consumer spending. The German company's shares have fallen to levels last seen in 2011. European car companies such as Volkswagen and Fiat owner Stellantis will find it tough to fight back. Making an EV is around 35% cheaper in China than in Europe because of the country's low labor costs and more robust EV supply chain. China's car makers are also willing to operate on razor-thin operating margins while they focus on winning market share. Governments in Southeast Asia, where economies have been hit hard by the oil crisis, want to improve their energy security. They see EVs as a way to reduce their dependence on imported gasoline and are rolling out policies to encourage drivers to buy them. Thailand cut excise taxes on imported electric cars, and the country's prime minister recently swapped his Rolls-Royce for a BYD as part of a national push to save energy, according to local news reports. Laos has banned the import of gasoline cars altogether for the rest of the year. Cambodia has announced EV-friendly policies such as lower customs duties. This is a problem for Japanese brands such as Toyota, for whom Southeast Asia is an important market, but who are losing share there even before the war. Between 2023 and 2025, Chinese car makers increased their share of new car sales in Malaysia, Indonesia, Thailand, Vietnam, the Philippines, and Singapore from 4% on average to 11%. Japanese brands have seen their share fall more than 10 percentage points to 57% over that time, data from PwC shows. What's happening today in the car industry has echoes of the disruption of Europe's solar panel business more than a decade ago. Beijing's generous subsidies created overcapacity in solar panel production, which led to disorderly competition and price wars inside China. Chinese companies then flooded overseas markets with the surplus. Global consumers benefited from cheaper goods, but at the expense of hollowing out local industries. High gasoline prices are making it more likely that consumers in countries have relatively low rates of car ownership will buy affordable Chinese EVs as their first cars. Some consumers might leapfrog gasoline cars altogether. Emerging markets are expected to account for 60% of global car demand over the next decade. Traditional car makers face a much tougher job getting a slice of the action. This article was by Karen Ryan from the Heard on the Street section of the Wall Street Journal. War helps Chinese EVs make inroads. This is your volunteer reader, Chuck Kaufman, bringing to a close this Tuesday edition of the Wall Street Journal here on Sun Sounds of Arizona, and reminding you, you can listen to Sun Sounds of Arizona on sunsounds.org or on the Sun Sounds of Arizona app, and of course, always on your Amazon Echo or Show.